Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players, uncover their stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, stick around. You're in the right place. Are you looking to buy or sell a home in the Tampa Bay area without having to deal with pushy realtors? Then make sure you connect with West Florida Real Estate. West Florida Real Estate has helped over 300 homeowners and investors buy and sell their properties over the last 5 years. Their service is outstanding, just like back in the days when there was actually service in the service business, and you'll never have to deal with any kind of sales junk when you're working with them. For more information, email Ann with an E at westfloridarealestate.com. That's A-N-N-E at westfloridarealestate.com. If you're enjoying this show and you'd like to support it, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/support. And for information on advertising, visit everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. Hey, everybody, this is Craig Garber. Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar. I've got a really cool guest today, very diverse guy. He's most well-known for his blues artistry, but he's also done other rock and experimental stuff with Eric Johansson out of New Orleans. Quick message, just make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com/subscribe, and you can subscribe to both the show on audio and on the YouTube channel. Let me tell you about Eric. New Orleans-based Eric Johansson started no relation to David, right?
No.
Yeah. He's got two S's, I think. New Orleans-based Eric Johansson started playing in bars at age 14. He's toured across the United States and internationally as lead guitarist for Cyril Neville and performed on stage with Tab Benoit, J.J. Gray, and Mofro, Eric Lindell, Mike Zito, Anders Osborne, the Neville Brothers, and many more. He also has a project called Empty Self, which is a solo down-tempo guitar and electric project. And he also has a progressive rock band called Sire. We'll talk about, and they both released a couple of albums on both of those. So it's Sire, C-I-R-E, and Empty Self, one word. He was recently signed to Whiskey Bayou Records, and his debut album, Burn It Down, was produced and engineered by Tab Benoit at his studio in Houma. Is that pronounced that right? I'm sorry.
Houma.
Featuring Tab on drums. How cool is that to be Tab Benoit, and then you produce a record and say, I'm going to play drums?
I think that's part of it. He loves playing drums.
So. That's really cool. Following its release, and it's a great record, and we'll talk about it, by the way. Following the album's release in 2017, Eric's been touring across the U.S., opening for Tab at sold-out theaters and performance halls. In early 2019, he released Blues in My Blood, which is an incredible blues record. Really great. It's a record he made with his first cousin, who's a singer, New Orleans blues and jazz singer. Her name is Tiffany Pollock. Man, this woman has a great, it's like, you know, Etta James and great blues guitar. It's really great. The album stayed in the top 10 of Roots Music Report's blues rock chart for 7 months, and it won an independent music award for best blues song and Blues Blast magazine award for best new artist debut album. I can tell you right now, it deserves every one of these awards. A great record, and we'll talk about that. And again, that record is called I didn't say the name of it. Hold on. I have it right up here on my iTunes. It's called Blues in My Blood. It's right here. Sorry about that. All righty. Eric, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate you coming on the show, man.
Yeah, glad to be here.
You started playing in bars at 14, man. How did you get so good so early? And then how did the word spread that you started getting gigs at that age?
I had a guitar since I was like five, so it wasn't a super quick path to being good in terms of years, because it was a lot of years where I knew how to play Twinkle Twinkle Little Star, and that's all I knew how to play, and I didn't really know where to progress from there. And then once I started figuring out how to pick out stuff from records, I had an older friend that played. And, you know, all of a sudden I started being like, well, can you teach me this Metallica song or whatever? Like, I want to know how to play this song, you know? And he would sit there with the CD and he would kind of pick out the riff. And then I watched him do that. And I I kind of was like, oh, okay, so you can just listen to it and just like find your way around and figure out where this riff is. And so then I just started listening to like all these records that I had that at the time were, you know, heavy rock records a lot when I was 11, 12, you know. And once I started being able to learn stuff from records and then play along with the records, that was pretty much my quick education in just how to play a bit. But then, you know, I had relatives that played and, you know, I had an uncle that was a bass player and he was doing like a bluesy thing. And so I was kind of into the blues stuff too, a little bit. I was into Hendrix and I started reading about, well, you know, who did Hendrix listen to and just kind of doing that whole backward thing from the guys that I was first introduced to and, oh, they were listening to Jimi Hendrix and who was Jimi Hendrix listening to and that kind of thing. And, so I started to kind of learn the basics of blues playing and, you know, jamming with people. And, you know, my uncle had this band, that he was doing where he was playing bass and singing and he was going through different guitar players. And I guess it, you know, around 14, I was good enough to go do some gigs with him and it just kind of took off from there. And, you know, then it kind of became the whole young gun blues guitar player thing, you know.
So you did a lot of woodshedding, but before that.
Yeah. I mean, I would say like between 11 and 14 was a big, huge transition in terms of just like, I mean, I would just spend every single Saturday and Sunday or, you know, day in the summer. Anytime I wasn't in school, I would be sitting there at the stereo, like picking out guitar stuff. And so, I mean, I kind of put myself through a crash course, you know, in guitar at that time.
Let me ask you something, if you could even answer this. Like, I've been taking lessons for a while. My teacher's like, you got to go out and play with other people, man. And so if you can quantify this, a year or 6 months of playing with others, is that like, what is that equal to playing on your own? Like, how much more accelerated?
Oh, I think it makes all the difference in the world to be playing with other people. I mean, thankfully for me, I almost immediately when I started messing around with playing guitar, I also had like a toy kind of drum machine.
Okay.
With like pre-programmed beats in it. I was always playing along with some timing thing.
Okay.
Like, so I think that helped. So that when I started playing with a real drummer, you know, I was used to keeping time with something. It wasn't just me playing the guitar because I was usually jamming along with drum machines and stuff like that. But I think that, I mean, playing in front of an audience, there's probably just something in your brain that tells you it matters more and you just start to make connections quicker.
Yeah. I mean, so you're forced to step up.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and just playing with other people as well, you know, because you're listening to each other and, you know, you're not just in your own world of what you're playing. You're also responding to what they're playing.
Very cool. You went to college and you majored in philosophy. I found that interesting. How come you didn't like study music?
When I decided to go to college, which was not a clear decision for me at first because I was already gigging and I knew that I wanted to be a musician. But around that time, I started to kind of wonder which direction I wanted to take musically. And you know, it was around the time where you decide if you're going to go to college or not. And I had free tuition from the state of Louisiana. You know, we had a program called TOPS where if you had, I mean, it could be like a 2.5 or above GPA, you could basically get free tuition at a state university. So I decided, you know, I was going to go and I wanted to go in New Orleans. And the University of New Orleans was the clear choice there. And their music program was exclusively a jazz program. There was no audio engineering. There was no music business. There was nothing except jazz. And I had a friend that was like a year older than me that had entered that program, and he loved it because that's what he wanted to do. But he was saying, you know, you basically, you've got instructors that say jazz is the only real music and you need to eat, sleep, and breathe jazz. And here I was already somewhat feeling like I had a little bit of an identity as a player.
Oh, yeah.
So to me, I didn't like the idea of having to, you know, go just study jazz for 4 years. Now, in retrospect, I think that you can benefit from all kinds of learning. And, you know, maybe, you know, there's times where it's like, oh, yeah, I kind of wish I had some of that knowledge, you know. Sure. But at the time, I, you know, being 18, I mean, I just kind of was like, well, I don't want somebody to tell me what I should sound like. You know, I mean, I was very kind of stubborn in that way.
I think so. Music's pretty personal, man. And I don't think that's a bad decision. I mean, if you're growing up on classic rock and you never put jazz on, you know, and you can listen to anybody. Oh, jazz is, you should learn it. But man, it's music. If you're not, you know, it's right. Like, I'd be miserable playing music I didn't like.
Yeah. You know, and there was also the thing of, I was starting to just get exposed to different ideas, you know, like, I mean, you know, I'm the philosophy thing is, it wasn't an accident. I mean, I was reading, you know, I was reading philosophy and I was, you know, just sort of questioning how things all fit together. So,
are you logical? Are you like super logical?
Yeah.
So it worked for you, philosophy.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm pretty, you know, I'd say I'm pretty scientifically oriented, you know, worldview wise and everything. But at the same time, you know, just the idea of how do we know what we know, and, you know, what's true and what's not. And, yeah. And you know, and just basically it just, you know, I grew up, growing up in the South, you know, it's not always around the most open-minded people all the time.
Yeah.
And so, you know, seeing that all these questions had been asked, like, you know, questioning any type of authority, and this had been going on for thousands of years. Right. And it just, you know, it's just really interested me, and it still does. So to me at that time, studying that sort of thing seemed to go perfectly along with music, because, you know, it's all part of a discovery of, you know, yourself and the world around you, and, you know, music and philosophy just seemed like a good blend.
Very cool, man. Yeah, I took a philosophy course. I liked it. It was really interesting. Katrina. Hurricane Katrina changed your life. How did that? Talk about that story. It's pretty interesting.
So, you know, you have a bit of advance warning usually with hurricanes down here. At that, when Katrina hit, I happened to be out of town. And I didn't know anything about anything developing in the Gulf. Somehow I must have been out of the loop on it. But, you know, I hadn't heard anything. And then as I was out of town for like a long weekend visiting my dad in the D.C. area, you know, my sister calls me, who also lives in New Orleans. And she said, you know, there's a storm headed and we're going to evacuate and all that. And she managed to go grab my cat. But she was in a two-seater car herself with her animals and, you know, things like that. So it was like, there wasn't any chance for anybody to grab any of my guitars or anything like that. And my apartment ended up, you know, taking about 5.5 feet of water inside. And it was raised up about 3 feet. You know, it was like 3 steps from the ground. So it was a good 7.5, 8 feet, where I lived. You know, so I lost everything in Katrina. And, I mean, it was in everything, like in terms of, you know, I mean, it wasn't like, you know, I was able to salvage a bunch of stuff. I mean, it just all went. And so I had like a weekend bag of clothes
At your dad's.
Yeah. And that's what I ended up with. And so I watched the whole thing happen from there, you know, watching it on TV, and then had to fly back to like a different, different city where my mom lived. And, so it was just kind of this immediate, you know, you leave for a weekend and then you don't have anything to go back to.
Were you this calm when it happened? Cause you're like, so like mellow about it. Were you freaking out?
The weird thing is it was a lot to take in at once because, there was the personal aspect of what was going on, which was kind of trying to figure out, you know, has my house been, you know, or my apartment been, affected by the flooding and stuff yet? And then, you know, they had maps, and then it was essentially like, okay, yeah, so I'm flooded now. But then you were also watching people on TV who were waiting on rooftops in the 100+ degree heat, running out of water, you know, people
with their dogs.
And then there was people just dying, and they would just have to leave the bodies in the streets. I mean, it was, you know, I mean, not to take it, you know,
no, that's what happened.
A depressing angle, but I mean, there was so much human tragedy going on at the time that it was hard for me to feel too sorry for myself about losing all the equipment, because I was just happy to not be stuck in the situation like a lot of people were. Yeah.
That's good. So you like, you shifted right away to like, are you always like that? Like, are you an optimist in general?
No, not at all, really.
Cause that's pretty optimistic.
I think I struggle sometimes with optimism, but I've never been faced with a situation like that where you're watching people going through some apocalyptic, you know, thing in the place that you live. And so the concept that you've lost everything, it did affect me. And I actually think that, you know, I've realized over time that it probably affected me more than I was aware of, at the time, because, you know, it's fine to say, well, you know, I can't really feel sorry for myself because look at the tragedy that these other people are going through, but it doesn't mean that you didn't go through something.
No, of course.
And that's kind of, you know, you kind of like just write off your own, psychological impact because you're saying, oh, well, that's nothing compared to somebody that watched somebody die, which it is nothing compared to that, but it's still something.
And I think that's a survival skill, to be honest. I think that's an automatic thing that kicks in to get you through that, the crisis, whatever you're dealing with.
Right. So, you know, it's still the biggest thing I ever went through, even if it wasn't, even if my version of it wasn't as big as someone else's. So,
did your cat make it?
You know, what's that?
Did your cat make it?
Yeah.
That's cool. That's good, man.
But, you know, it was an interesting thing because, you know, I didn't have hardly any money at that time anyway. I had, you know, I'd just gotten out of college. And I was kind of just trying to, like, you know, I was rehearsing with some new guys for the Sire project. And, you know, I had just been working on the Empty Self thing too. But you know, no real money. And so when I lost everything, I lost my recording equipment, my guitars, all that stuff. It was really kind of a break with everything I had going at the time. It was really, I mean.
Did you have any insurance on your guitars at least?
No.
Oh,
no.
Man, that's a bummer.
I didn't pay any bills that I wasn't required to pay.
I hear you, man. Like,
you know, I know there was no recourse really. And, you know, because if you owned a house, you had to go back and clean up the wreckage or deal with the insurance company. But if you were renting and you lost all your stuff inside, and then that's just it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it was just, everybody was just gutting houses. And, I mean, first of all, I didn't go back for about a month and a half. It took a good 3-4 weeks or more. It took a while for the water to even get pumped out of the city and for them to say, okay, it's safe to come back and mess with your things.
Where did you stay?
People that snuck back in. What's that?
Where were you? Did you stay up at your dad's or did you?
I ended up flying back to my mom. My mom lived in Alexandria, Louisiana.
Okay.
And I flew back there, and I was kind of back on her couch.
Yeah.
You know? But yeah. So you know, it definitely it was a big moment, because you know, it basically meant that I had to choose a new path, no matter what it was, because it wasn't really. I mean, New Orleans was in a state of rebuilding for quite some time after then. And because so many places were destroyed, if you were looking for a new place to live, you know, there was a scarcity there of places. So it wasn't actually an easy place to come back to if you didn't already have a place to live at that time, because, you know, the competition for viable places to live when half of them just, I mean, 80% of the city was underwater. So it would have been a daunting thing to even come back to the city at that time, which is why I didn't immediately, you know.
So you're hanging out at your mom's. What's going through your head? Because in a way, it's kind of like not a good thing, but in how many, you know, sometimes you need a clean start on stuff, but like to do it on your own, it's like, man, I'm not doing that. I got to unwind a lot of shit. But you had no choice in a sense.
Right.
In a very literal sense. It's like,
right.
It's like, okay, you just graduated high school again that day.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I pretty quickly latched onto the idea of moving to New Zealand, honestly. And I think that was part of the reason, was just that any road toward anything at that point seemed difficult.
Yes.
So the road toward saving up money to try to get an apartment back in New Orleans while it was struggling with all of these issues was a really hard thing to feel optimistic about. But saving up money to go somewhere else that was, you know, it seemed exciting, that gave me some optimism and positivity, you know. I started latching onto the idea of well, I'm just going to move to New Zealand and, you know, ..
Why New Zealand? Why not Greece or England? Or like, did you have family there or something? Or,
well,
are you into sheep?
No, I didn't have any family there. I mean, I think partially, honestly, you know, all I know how to speak is English, and it's one thing to, I'd like to experience every place that I can. But as far as just picturing, no, I think I could live somewhere. Like, I want to be able to speak to the people, you know. But I mean, New Zealand is unique. I mean, it's got its own environment, you know, its own, you know, it's very kind of environmentally conscious country, and very, it's a very peaceful, uncorrupt place to be. And, you know, I just started reading all these things about it. And there's also, you know, it's not super easy to immigrate everywhere. And New Zealand is not necessarily easy, but they had avenues you could take if you were, you know, of a certain like age group, because they had a lot of their young population moves overseas for a while. So there was a path to immigration that I found, you know, as essentially a skilled migrant, you know, a college educated person of a certain age group, you know, they had a way that you could come to the country and work for a little while. And then if you kind of got your footing, you could reapply and get a more permanent visa, which I did. I'm a permanent resident of New Zealand.
what was the trigger? Like, where did you first get the idea of New Zealand?
There was a friend of mine, that had it as their dream that they still never pursued even to this day. But they started talking to me about it, and I honestly did not know the first thing about New Zealand at the time.
And why would
so
you?
I started researching it, and I was just like, well, this place looks amazing, like, you know, beautiful, and, you know, And I just kind of started finding out more about it. And you know, there were other things where, I mean, I just kind of, being poor in a place like New Orleans and then having that happen, you know, I didn't have this idea that I'd be able to travel a lot of places, that I'd be able to, you know, so just the goal of, can I accomplish this? You know, can I move somewhere else that wasn't an accident of my birth, you know, wasn't just like, yeah, where I have to be born, but can I just like put a pen on a map and go there and do this? You know, so I mean, that partly was just, you know,
sort of like a challenge or a goal.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's pretty, you know what, man, that's really cool.
I think that's really cool. I still think really fondly of it. And, you know, I wish that the flights weren't so expensive and that it wasn't so hard to kind of bounce back and forth. If I ever have the financial means, I'd love to have a place there for, you know, to visit, but it's a great place, you know.
What did you get out of that? How long were you there for?
I was there for about 4.5 years.
What did you get out of that experience?
Well, I got sort of a relief of the pressure of feeling like I would always be stuck in one situation, which, you know, whether it might be politically or however you want to look at it, you know, there's that feeling of knowing, well, you know, you escaped the situation you were born with. And I was able to sort of blow off a certain amount of like steam psychologically. I don't know how to explain it really. It's just that, man, that,
I think I know what you're talking. You had these limits or these preconceived notions that you had limits is what it sounded like. And this helped you realize maybe I don't have limits.
Right.
That's fucking great, man.
Yeah. I think that, you know, I know for me personally, you know, right now there's a lot of turmoil in the world, and, you know, and I these days, you know, I try to keep from arguing with people online and things like that. So I don't, you know,
I'll say that anything. That's how you do it. To say nothing.
Well, I'll leave that to people that don't have to try and sell tickets to make a living. But you know, I think that there's a lot of times where, you know, somebody will win an election or something and people will be like, oh, I'm going to move to Canada, or I'm going to do this, which is fine.
Right.
But the thing is, nobody really cares where you live, and it doesn't make a difference. Right. So you can be from France sitting in Alabama and be, you know, you could have whatever opinions you have. It doesn't, I mean, the things you care about, you're still going to care about. So you can go somewhere else. You're still going to care about those things. And, you know, you're still going to care about the issues that affect where you're from, because you're going to still be affecting your family, and they're going to be affecting other people's families, even if it's not you.
Sure.
So you're still going to care about those things. But at the same time, the small picture of your life and what you're trying to do with your career is more of what you have to focus on a day to day. You know what I mean? I think, you know, it's funny how I guess when you're younger, the kind of happily ever after thing type of thinking seems to make more sense. And then you kind of realize, you know, you look at your watch and you're like, so life has still got a long way to go here. Like, you know, what's next, you know? So, I mean, I kind of thought, well, if I can just get somewhere beautiful and I can just live there, then that'll be it. And then it's like, well, okay, but, you know, I started to realize that, you know, playing music live and doing this for a living was, you know, really important to me. Like, was I really prepared to get some other type of job just so that I could live
there? What did you do there? What?
Well, so it's kind of funny because, right after Katrina happened, I started, I got a job working for a law firm doing kind of quasi paralegal stuff.
Right.
And it wasn't something I was trained in, really. It was just.
This is back in New Orleans.
Well,
before you left, or in Alexandria?
In Alexandria. Okay. It was after Katrina, but, you know, it was essentially like this guy that it would come see me play, and he was a lawyer, and he said, hey, you know, if you need a job. And I was like, and so it ended up being like reviewing documents for these big class action suits.
Right.
So I was doing that on the computer anyway. And then when I was going to quit, basically, I was like, all right, well, you know, I'm going to be leaving at such and such time. And he's like, well, you know, you're doing this stuff on the computer anyway. You can continue doing it.
Holy shit. So you had a built-in job working at home when you moved over.
To-
wow.
Yeah.
So that worked out really well. That's a headache less.
Yeah, it did. You know, and it kind of delayed me having to figure out, you know, what I was going to do, for money over there, because I mean, I wasn't like making a lot of money or anything, but it was enough to keep me, you know, sustained. And, you know, and I was just working on recording and stuff like that. But, you know, I really started to miss the live music thing. It's funny how, you know, you take for granted a lot about where you're from, you know, until you leave.
Yes.
And just the whole sort of roots music thing that is really common down here, where, you know, it doesn't matter whether you're in the Zydeco or blues or roots rock or whatever it is, but people a lot of times grow up jamming with each other and just kind of getting together and making it up on the spot, or maybe you know some standard songs or whatever, but you know, you can just get together and make music, and there's, you know, there's also a really big audience of people that likes to see live music here. You know, I sort of, when I went to New Zealand, part of the idea was, you know, it doesn't matter where I am. I can just be writing music and I can be recording music. And that kind of went hand in hand with the electronic, like, aspect of things, because, you know, I was interested in exploring, you know, beyond just trying to sound like a band. And so that was part of me wanting to mess around with more electronics, but it also went hand in hand with self-sufficiency and, you know, being able to create music without having to put classified ads up and see if I could meet the right people. I was just going to create stuff on my own, you know.
Did you, so like when you moved there, you literally knew nobody.
No, I knew some people online that I had started talking to that were like radio
expats.
DJs.
Oh, okay, cool.
They were from the UK, but and then they kind of introduced me to some people, and you know, I met other people from the music scene there, which was a heavily dance music oriented scene there. Yes. It was kind of before EDM really hit here in the US, because when I left, I had never heard of dubstep or anything like that, and I heard of all that stuff over there. And then when I came back to the States like 4 or 5 years later, it was like oh, it's here now, you know. But they were in a lot of the people that I knew over there were into the electronic scene, and I was kind of interested in how my background and those things might intersect, and you know, so I knew a couple of people that were in the music world there. You know, but it's really the whole intersection between technology and music has been something that's interested me. And I guess I've kind of come back around to, you know, wanting to do things in an organic way for the most part. But at that time, it made a lot of sense for me to be exploring those avenues, because that was something that I could do on my own.
Were you playing music there at all? Out?
I not at first. At first I was just thinking, I'll just explore, you know, recording and working on the Empty Self project. Eventually I started to realize, man, I miss just like improvising, you know, and just playing, in the moment, you know. And then I started to find some people to play with, and I ended up with like doing a.
So you bought a guitar while you were over there or something?
Yeah. Well, I had actually acquired a couple of guitars, shortly after Katrina.
Okay.
There were a couple of music foundations that were working with musicians affected by Katrina that helped them get instruments.
That's cool.
You know, I lost a Taylor acoustic guitar, and I wrote the company, and they sold me a replacement for like half price. And then
Tim,
what's that?
Tim Godwin. Did he do that?
I don't remember. Honestly, it's so many years ago.
Oh, that was a long time ago. That's true.
But and then there was another foundation that helped me get like a main like electric guitar. And then those were the two guitars I had for years, like probably for the next 10 years. I think I had like an aversion to acquiring more guitars because I was like scared of losing them or something. But
dude, I can't blame you.
So I had a guitar, and I mean, that was all, guitar has always been a part of what I do. I just realized that there's a difference between constructing music to live on a recording and sort of the live improvisational thing that I'd grown up doing. And it seems obvious, but somehow it wasn't obvious to me at first, you know.
I don't think anything's like, obvious until you go through it, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
How would you know I'm going to miss this, because you've never had a break from it.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And you had in all fairness to yourself, he had so much other shit going on. Like,
right.
You know, if you had to put an inventory list of all the crap you had to deal with, it was like, it was pretty big stuff, you know, all of it, you know?
Yeah.
It's hard to think about, you know, music when you don't have a place to live.
Right. You know, it's interesting that, you know, I still think about, music can be a lot of different things. And when you look at music as an art form, then the difference between playing a song with a band and making an electronic collage of music, they're just, you know, if you look at them like canvases hanging on a wall, they're just two different forms of art, you know, and they all can be valid. And you know, all of that interests me, and experimenting beyond what a band should sound like and going, well, maybe the drums don't even sound like drums, you know, maybe like all of that stuff from a purely creative frame of mind makes sense. But from a lifestyle angle, if you are a musician that has grown up playing with other human beings and improvising, then they're very different, because on the one hand, you're essentially creating a file on a computer. And on the other hand, you're living and breathing the music in the moment and reinterpreting it every time you play it. So that's what I mean by it. Like, it seems obvious, because some people who I now am surrounded with, they never went through the process of like questioning, you know, things to that degree of like, do I even want to sound like a band? Does it even need to sound like human beings? Like, you know, like, but for me, once I started looking at it as just art, it all those things were in question, because I was like, well, why do I necessarily want to sound bluesy, or why do I necessarily want to even sound like a band? You know? But I guess the answer to that I've reached now is because as a lifestyle and as a healthy activity for myself, playing with other people and, you know, actually having the music coming through my hands and my body and, you know, being organically involved in it like that is, it's totally different than creating,
a file.
Creating sounds. Yeah. You know, because it's, you end up when you get into the electronic side of things, you end up where you play the music back but the music starts to live on the computer or on the recording of whatever you're doing. And when you play what I'm doing now, where it's like a trio and it's like me and a drummer and a bass player, the music lives in you. And every time you play it back, you're playing it back through your whole being. And, it's very different, you know? And I think it's, if the only way you've ever known to create music is from a computer and you don't come from a background of playing instruments, then maybe that works for you. But if you come from playing, you know, guitar and playing with other people, I think pressing play on a keyboard is never gonna, or on a computer is never gonna do it for you, you know?
Yeah. So what was the trigger then that you finally said, okay, I'm going to go back? Because that's just as much of a bold move sort of to go back as it was to go over there. I mean, probably not as hard, but to, you know, everybody comes to decisions every day. Like you said, you met this person and they wanted to go to New Zealand. They still haven't gone, you know? And it's funny when you mentioned that, I thought of, my wife is from England, and I guess like in the late 90s, we were over in England and we're in like her local, she's from a little town. We're in her local supermarket and the woman behind the cashier is looking at my wife. She goes, did you go to, you know, whatever high school or whatever? And she goes, yeah. She goes, and it turns out it was someone that she knew from high school. And she said, you know, what do you, you know, and Anne said, oh, this is my husband. And I think maybe one or two of our kids were there. And she goes, oh, you're like, she heard my accent. Obviously I'm not British. And she said, oh, you, do you live in America? And she said, Anne said, yes. My wife said, yes. And the woman said, I was always going to do that when I was younger. And I really have a lot of respect for people like my wife, to be honest with you, and you, that you just said, hey man, I want to do this, but you actually pull the trigger.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. And that's with any major decision. How many people, I'd love to play on stage. I'd love to run a business. But it takes balls. There's a vetting process, and the vetting process is, do you have the balls to do it? One of the vetting processes. So what made you come back? Because I think it did take a lot of balls just to come back now.
What brought me back? I guess it was kind of a lot of thoughts creeping in over a period of time. You know, I kind of, when I would see, I came back to visit family, obviously. And there was just this kind of pull of feeling like, you know, I'm not quite doing what I should be doing. It's hard to explain, because I think there was some mental block that I had up in my head that was there to sort of keep me sane, you know, like
about performing professionally.
Yeah, like I missed performing, and I think I knew that on a certain level. And I know there was a lot of time where I really didn't want to listen to certain types of music because it would make me sad for whatever reason.
Because you weren't doing, you know, that.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Man.
So like,
if I heard,
you know, some kind of bluesy rock on somewhere, and there was this part of me that's like, why is this making me feel bad?
Oh.
And I think part of it was because it's like, I remembered how much joy it gave me to be on stage. And the fact that I had done this type of stuff at an early age, you know, and, you know, sort of took it for granted. It's not like I took it for granted, but, you know, the whole aspect of playing in front of people and playing improvisational music and everything, it started to creep back up in my head. But I was like, well, what am I supposed to do about that? If that's what I need to be doing and I can't figure out how that works here, then what does that mean? And, you know, it was daunting to think about coming back again. And it wasn't immediately clear to me, to be honest with you, that it would, that it would be New Orleans. I thought, well, maybe I need to try somewhere else.
Sure.
You know, I had some friends in LA and I had, you know, the idea of maybe Austin or something, you know, because there was a lot of emotional stuff with coming back to New Orleans, I think, after going through.
Oh God. Yeah.
Katrina. But I still, you know, I love New Orleans but you know, when I was coming back, just to visit, I kind of reconnected with some kind of members of the New Orleans music community a little bit. Okay. You know, I'd kind of been introduced to Cyril Neville, before Katrina, and, you know, the Neville brothers are like, you know, New Orleans music.
Yeah, royal, they're like the Statue of Liberty in New York.
Yeah. So, you know, so I came back and I think he had like a birthday party jam gig, and I went, and some people knew that I played or whatever, and I ended up jamming with him and all these people. And I was just like, man, this never, and this is not to put New Zealand down in any way, shape, or form.
Sure.
But it was a very unique New Orleans experience.
Yeah.
It made me realize that, like, look, even after leaving for 4 years, you know, I still had more of a musical connection, more of a web of connections here, and I was more tied into something important here than I had any even start of being tied into in New Zealand, which is, again, you know, I knew some great people over there and I still do. But I kind of, it was just one of those things where I sort of realized, you know, that this is part of my story here, that, you know, this is where I'm from. And this is part of, you know, even though I don't play traditional Louisiana music by any means, but it's still part of me, and it's still part of, you know, my story. And I'm to be able to come back and have such a vivid, like, experience of just playing with all these musicians who are internationally known, some
yes.
of them, you know? So it wasn't just like, it just kind of showed me, it's like, you know, there's a nucleus of something real here that I have a place in, that I want to participate in, you know, I want to be a part of it. And it's something, and it's also, there was also funny moments where, like, you know, having been in New Zealand, where somebody would ask me about some artist back in New Orleans that I knew,
right,
you know, or knew somebody that we were at a jam together or something like that. And I'm thinking, well, that never happens the other way around. I mean,
yeah. You know, hey, do you know this New Zealand artist called? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, not to say that they don't, you know, again, they have some people that have made it out of there and stuff, but like, not in the roots blues world, you know.
I totally get it, man.
And it's so the more that I started realizing that, you know, I miss doing this kind of music, the more that it just made sense to come back here. And then I guess I was just waiting for the catalyst. And then, you know, Cyril ended up asking me if I could, you know, be his guitar player for a while. And it wasn't even a really huge line of gigs he had lined up or anything like that. It was just enough for me to say, hey, you know what? Why not? I'm just going to come back for a while and
wow.
see.
So this whole thing with, isn't it funny how life is, man? So you get this tragedy, Hurricane Katrina, set you off on a pretty like good personal growth path and for your life. Yeah. That's really, that's, I'm glad something good of that came for, of that for you. That's really,
yeah,
that's a good story, man.
Yeah. You know, and like I say, man, I, you know, I think that, you know, you talk about people who say, oh, I always wanted to do this. I think it's a really good idea to try to do some of those things and to get out of your comfort zone. And especially if you think, you know, oh, I got to get out of this place, you know, well, then you should try.
Yeah.
Because it might show you that some of those things are the place and some of those things are your mind, and that you can't really trace out what is your mind and what is your town until you separate the two.
Yeah.
Because, you know, all you know of your reality on Earth, if it's existed in one place, then you can't separate what's inside and outside. And you essentially have to put yourself in a new context to go, you know, what are internal things that I'm working out and battling with versus what are external things that I have an issue with. And mostly, you know, there's a ton of stuff that gets on my nerves about, you know, New Orleans is I mean, I love it.
Oh, every but, place, know, dude,
we
every,
have to, yeah. We have a boil advisory. It seems like every 2 months where we have to boil the water, there's, you know, potholes everywhere. There's a number of things that sure. you can say or get on your nerves, but you realize that they don't actually rise to the point of, you know, that the bigger things that you're wrestling with are probably internal.
Yeah.
Most of the time. And so, you know, it definitely helped me to see a little bit more about that, to get away and then come back.
Good for you, man. What a good story. What a good happy ending too, man. That's nice. Very cool. Thank you for sharing all that, man. And I like your summary there, spoken like a true philosophy major. I'm waiting for your course to come out. I'll be the first buyer.
Yeah. But
it's true though. I talk to people all the time and they're like, oh man, I, you know, it's winter time. It's nice here in Florida. It's chilly for us, but it's warm for the rest of the world. Man, yeah. I hate living here. I'd love to move to Florida. I'm like, dude, they got planes wherever you're at. You know, you can leave. Yeah. Right. I mean, I wasn't from here. So I get what you're saying, you know, yeah, you got to do shit.
And I understand, you know, like that it's difficult to make those changes. And I did have an opportunity that not a lot of people have. Now, I didn't come from money or anything like that. It didn't come from anything like that, but it came from having everything stripped away. That was a type of an opportunity. You know? Yeah.
But just the way you're looking at it is what allowed you to take advantage of it. Most people wouldn't say, well, I had an opportunity, when they're referring to everything they own was lost. You yeah. know what I'm saying? And I agree with you. I think it's a great way to look at it. It's a healthy way to look at it. And what are you going to do? Be bitter about it? Like, it's not going to change it.
Right.
But that's part of why you were successful in my mind, because you looked at this. I have an, this is an, let me not, you know, let me make chicken salad out of chicken shit, sort of, right? Or let me make, yeah. you know, lemonade out of lemons. And I think when people look at things like that, their likelihood of succeeding, of making, is better than like, oh, poor me, what can I, not to minimize anybody who's obviously in a hurricane.
Yeah.
But, you know, like everything in life, man, you know, it's how you look at it and how you react to it more so than the event itself. So good yeah. story, man. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah, man. Thank you very much. It was really cool. 2017, your first solo record, Burn It Down, comes out. And this just past year, 2019, you released Blues in My Blood with Tiffany Pollock, who's your first cousin. What was the difference in your approach, or like, what did you learn from making your first solo record that made making the record with Tiffany different, easier, what, more less stressful?
Well, they were very different, in the sense that, you know, the record with Tiffany, it was just kind of like, you know, we had the opportunity to, Sorry.
No, it's good, man. You can keep going.
Let me just.
Yeah, it's good.
Decline. Okay, sorry. I was getting a call.
All good, man.
But it was probably a junk call. So, yeah, the record with Tiffany was different in that we didn't really have any expectations of doing it as a band, like touring off of it or anything. It was just kind of like, you know, hey, do you want to do this? And there was, I forget exactly how it came about, but there's a label called Nola Blue. This is their label that put it out. And somehow they had gotten in contact with Tiffany and they were aware of me, and they kind of said, well, what if you guys did a record together? And so she presented me with this idea of like, do you want to do a record together? You know, essentially it was going to be paid for. So I was just like, well, yeah, I mean, why wouldn't you want to go in the studio and make music
on someone else's nickel on top of that? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they're great people. So, you know, I was just kind of like, well, yeah, I mean, there's nothing really to lose there.
Yeah.
So, you know, so we didn't really have any expectations of it needing to fit a certain band format or anything. Whereas the record that I did with Tab, I very much wanted to keep it a trio thing, you know,
drums, bass, I'm really guitar.
I'm really into the power trio thing for a number of reasons. There's practical reasons, and there's also I think that when you have less stuff going on, every person gets to put more of themselves into it. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
I do. But you know, so and they were a little bit different in that the Tab record, the Burn It Down, was very live recorded. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was pretty much live in studio. I redid a few of the vocals just to get a different mic and like not have the background noise in there and stuff. But I mean,
your voice is really, sorry to interrupt you, man. Your voice is good. Really good. It's amazing how many people, like when you talk to somebody and when they're singing, it's almost never the same voice. Not that you have a great speaking voice. It's really deep, but it's when you hear someone sing, you know, you have to, vocals are hard, man. It's really hard to sing well. I think so. It's really hard to sing well. And you don't, you know, there's a disconnect between talking to somebody and then hearing them, for me anyway, and then hearing them sing. Your voice sounded great on that record, man. Really, really well.
Oh, thanks. I kind of feel like I essentially sing in a conversational way, sort of. Like, I mean, I don't have like this other, some people I really, like you say, I really can't connect their singing voice with their speaking voice at all. I'm like, right. How does that even, you know, I don't really affect my voice much with singing. I, you know,
well, you know what it was? But, I wasn't familiar with your music till after we had a physical conversation, I think.
Oh, okay.
So I like, this is your voice. I think I heard we spoke on the phone briefly, I think, if I remember. And then I listened to your music. So it's like, wow. It's just always weird. It's just a different context that I'm listening to somebody, and so it's me, man. It's a disconnect. But your voice is great. That being said, I really enjoyed it. Yeah.
Thanks. I mean, you know, yeah. I you know, like I say, I mean, the Burn It Down record was very live, and the Blues in My Blood record, it was a bit more. A little more production and a little more like deciding, oh, okay, you know, maybe it should start off on acoustic guitar and then electric guitar comes in, you know, stuff that you can only do in the studio, which is cool too. You know, so it's two different approaches, about as different as you could be while still being in the roots, you know, both in the roots realm, because I mean, we did record like the Blues in My Blood record. We did record the core rhythm track. There was always guitar, bass, drums, sometimes also keyboard, recording and playing at the same time for the main track. But we did a little bit more of overdubbing and stuff like that.
Post-production. Did you I mentioned this to you before we started talking, the Blues in My Blood record, your record was less tradition. It's a blues record. I don't want to come across it. It's a blues record, but it's wider and it's not as deep blues as the record you did right. with your cousin. It's a wider variety of blues, whereas as the record with Tiffany is like very deep blues.
Yeah, it's, you know, that's something that I
like. What's the real you? Is it in a sense? I don't. I know it's all the real you, but where it is, like, where do you see your next record? I know you're getting ready to work on another record. Where do you see that?
You know, that is something that I am thinking through even right now, and it's something that I've kind of wrestled with a good bit, because essentially, whenever you start trying to make something more original, or yeah. you essentially immediately deviate from something that you would call traditional blues.
Right.
So it's very hard to find that balance between, I mean, because honestly, most early classic rock is essentially just blues riffs.
100%.
So it's like, what do you consider blues and what do you consider having crossed out of it? And I think that's that, you know, for me, the centerpiece of keeping it blues in the sense that I want to keep it is that it's based on human performance, expressing yourself through the instrument, versus like double tracking rhythm guitars and then laying a solo on top. Like, it's like, you know, it's an organic thing. There's a lot of dynamics, things like that. You know, whether or not a record needs to have this type of blues song, that type of blues song, that's something that's kind of hard for me to stick to, because, you know, again, it's like, yeah.
Nor should you, man, because then you're not being you.
Right. And it's something that it's tricky, because, like, you know, I enjoy playing a straight slow blues a lot. I enjoy playing a straight, like, Texas type shuffle. I enjoy playing that stuff.
Right.
But it's always like, am I, you know, how much should I stick to those structures and how much should I not? And you know, I know for the Burn It Down record, it's funny. I figured, well, you know, let me collect some song ideas that I have that are kind of unique and different. And then maybe I'll get in the studio, and then maybe Tab, you know, Benoit, who's produced it, maybe he'll say, well, okay, that's cool, but then let's also throw on a straight up shuffle or a straight up slow blues or whatever. And he didn't really suggest any of that. He was just, we basically went through the little list of different type ideas I had. And then he was like, well, that's about 10 or 11 songs. So I was like, oh, okay. Well, you know, that's not really a blues record, but he was like, well, it's bluesy. And I'm like, yeah, I mean, you know, so, I mean, I thought that record was going to come out a little bit more steeped in tradition a little bit than it did. But, you know, I guess it really, it is natural for me to experiment with the structure more. And not, you know, I'm not really into trying to be retro or anything like that. Like, I'm not trying to sound of a certain time period.
Sure.
So I'm into music from a lot of different time periods, but I want to be honest about whatever comes out of me right now. I don't want to try to sound like I'm in the 50s or the 30s or whatever. So
unless that's how you're feeling when you write that particular song.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is great, which I think is wonderful.
So, you know, that whole thing is a really, what is blues, what isn't, what belongs, what doesn't. It's a tricky one. I mean,
the whole, just let me just clarify, I want it for everybody listening, the whole, it's a blues record, but yeah. It's wider in blues scope than, you know, the Blues in My Blood, which is more traditional soulful blues.
Right.
You know, like when you want to, like, when you're feeling like shit and you have a drink, that's the record you listen to, you know, because that's going to bring you out and, like, touch you from the blues standpoint. Whereas Burn It Down is like, it's more upbeat, you know, and it's great, but it's just, it was different. They're very noticeable.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, honestly, it's all I can hope is that I, you know, I can release a lot of stuff, because honestly, there's sometimes where I'll be sitting there with a, you know, with a resonator and, you know, just, you know, playing like on my national or something like that. And I just think, man, I could just make a whole record like this with just like acoustic, you know, and slide guitar. And then there's other times where, you know, I got this big electric sound going and like, I just think, man, am I almost too hard rock to be, you know? So it's like, I like all kinds of stuff, and it's, I just try to let it all fit together. However it fits together. I just, you know, the blues aspect of, the record I made with Tiffany, I think, you know, there's something when we come together too, that, you know, she comes from a jazzier blues angle and I come from a more rock and roll blues angle. And, for the most part. And I think when, you know, the place where we meet in the
that's exactly right. Where you met in the middle is that what that record for yeah. sure. And dude, when you pick up that resonator, man, that sounds wonderful. I mean, it really, I love those, the sound of that, especially when someone knows what they're doing on it, which is definitely not me, but
when they're magical.
No,
yeah.
Well, they're magic when the right, like I said, when someone knows what they're doing on it, but you sound great on that. I enjoyed every lick of that, man. Oh, it was great. I picked up my guitar for both records, like most of the songs. I mean, it was cool. Varying. Yeah, definitely. I love listening to that. It sounded great, you know. Very.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, and the resonator stuff was really inspiring. Like if I had the balls, not the balls, but the time really, or the time really to pick up a resonator, that's the record I'd want to listen to, man. It was great.
Yeah. You know, I love using I used a resonator on one song on the Burning Down record on a song called The Fugitive, and we ran it through an amp and mic'd it and stuff. They can be tricky to work with live, in a band setting, you know, cause they pick up like everything, the sound of the room resonates through them too. So it's definitely something that, I love, you know, and I don't use them as much live all the time. I'm trying to kind of work them in more, but they're honestly, like lately I've been writing on, I've got two resonators and
I see them right over there, man.
Yeah. They just seem to be, the most inspiring thing to sit down and write with lately.
Do you, well, you just mentioned, I hope to get to release a bunch of stuff. What are you looking to do more of over the next few years?
Well, you know, I kind of, I've haven't released as much music as I would like. And part of that has just been the twists and turns I've taken in life and then kind of trying to do things in a way that makes sense. You know, once I started working with Tab's label and everything, you know, when you work with, labels, however small or big, you know, they put their time and effort into making a release, and you don't just throw up a bunch of stuff on the internet every time you finish it, because, you know, you're trying to promote the thing that you released. Somehow or another, I would like to increase the pace of that. And I don't know, you know, what direction that's going to take, but, you know, I think that this type of music is not really, it's not stuff that you want to over obsess over. You know, that's part of the thing is you're not completely trying to reinvent the wheel when you do blues music, because there's obviously a tradition that you're carrying on in one sense or another. So, you know, sometimes it feels like, you know, every time you play it, it's things are slightly different, you sure. know? So, you know, I mean, we'll see, you know, obviously, you know, you have to think somewhat from a business standpoint, but, you know, I'm just eager to do more material and, you know, and explore more and just put it out there and not be, I mean, I kind of spent a long time of my life, let's say, overthinking things, you know, and releasing things very sporadically and, writing a bunch of stuff and throwing it in the trash and, you know, starting over. And, you know, sometimes you kind of just have to just kind of not be your own editor as much and just yes. kind of put things out there.
Good is good enough.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. You know, you don't really have a good perspective on what you do.
That's why people have producers.
Right. You know,
especially if you're analytical, you know, you go in and try to mix it and do everything yourself. It's like, I've spoken to guys who are like, man, I'm tortured because I, you know, I'm waking up in the middle of the night and I'm thinking, oh my God, that fifth guitar track, I really need to change it. And it's like, you know, you don't know when enough is enough sometimes when you are too close to something.
Yeah. Well, that right there, what you just said, is another reason why I'm really into the trio thing, because I need some parameters, because there's already so much that you can question about what you're doing that if I at least confine myself to a guitar part and a vocal part and a bass and a drum part, then at least I've stopped a lot of that.
Yeah.
You know, 10,000 didgeridoos, you know, type of stuff. Like, you know, like,
totally get it, man. At least
you've kind of limited it some way to where it's like, okay, well, if this part isn't right, then you've only got a couple of like elements you can change. And that to me keeps some of that at bay.
So having gone through this whole sort of catharsis and learning period, is there anything, like, if you had to go back and give young Eric advice, assuming you're going to listen to yourself, was there anything you would have told yourself to make life easier and, you know, professionally, personally, anyway?
Well, one thing that, you know, because I get asked for advice sometimes from younger players and stuff like that, and I would suggest being involved in music one way or another. Even if you just work the door at a club, I mean, it sounds silly, but the more that you get involved in music, it's just good to see multiple aspects of the process. I did help out at a studio when I was really young. Like, I literally, you know, looked up in the phone book the local recording studio that I could find and asked if I could come help out, you know, like, in exchange for just being able to see what was going on. And so I think I started at like 12 or
something like that. Wow, that must have been a great experience.
Yeah, and I would just coil up cables. I would go hook up a microphone. But I learned a ton of stuff from that. You know, so I think getting involved in various aspects of the music world is always good. That's probably something if I was to go back and tell myself, like, look, it's cool that you're trying to discover your own sound, but there's nothing wrong with trying to help out, you know, with somebody else's music or something, just because it helps you to see different things that you don't already know about. You know, it's not so much like a making connections thing. There is part of that because, of course, it helps to know people.
Definitely.
But it also just helps you see, if you see how managers operate and agents operate and all this kind of stuff, then you know who you're talking to. You know, you're not just sending emails like, hey, check out my music, to people without any idea of who you're speaking to or whatever. So
I actually think that's some of the best advice I've been given since doing this show. Honestly, I mean, like, even if you're older, and you're like thinking about making a record, you call up the local. Who's not going to say, hey man, you can't work here for free, especially if you like go down there and meet with somebody and they see, like, you know,
right.
You're together, you're not a druggie, you're genuine, you're interested in learning. Like, who would say, no, you can't help out and roll cables for free or set up mics or something like that for free? I mean, that's a great idea, man.
Yeah. And, you know, honestly, there were times where I took a runner position for a concert promoter, you know, like, Like, in other words, like, you know, they have some big band coming in and you drive the band around while they're there and stuff. I did that a few times. And it's like, you know, you see different aspects of the process that are above the level that you're at. And that's always informative, you know?
I think that's, and then you're meeting people.
Musical thing, but what's that?
But you're meeting people. So then if you have a question that's relevant, now at least you have a source. Hey, I'm doing this. Do you know anybody that I could bounce this question? I mean, it's like contacts, which is critical in this business.
Yeah. Because, you know, there's always, anytime you think about like cold calling, you know, people in the industry, I mean, you know, it doesn't hurt, but at the same time, if you can kind of, you know, get to know people, personally, it helps. I mean, as far as musical things, I wish I had known, I suppose, I don't know. It's good to, you know, learn different styles and stuff like that. But, you know, again, like I there are times where I think like, oh, I probably could have learned something from studying more officially. I never really had any formal music instruction, but I suppose that is a common thing.
Extremely.
As well.
So. Yeah. Or else, you know, guys that are session players, one of the things they say is, I wish I would have read a little better.
Yeah.
You know. Hey, let's talk about gear for a few minutes. I know you got those resonators there. What's your go-to guitar right now, and what other few guitars would round out your top, you know, three or four?
Well, like I just got this National Collegian like a month ago, which
it's one of those. Is that right back there?
Yeah, it's the shinier one.
Can you grab that, man? I just would love to hear you just play like anything on it, because it sounds great when you play that thing, man.
Yeah.
Here goes, man. Now we're in for a treat.
Yeah, this thing is awesome. I had wanted one for a while.
Oh,
just
it sounds so good, man. Even out of this, like, even through your iPhone or your iPhone, it sounds like so good, man.
Yeah, it's magical.
What?
These things.
What? How do you tune that? What tuning is that in?
This is in D. And one of the cool things about having two resonators now, the other one's a Regal, and it actually sounds really good. I have to say, like, I picked it up for $400 and it's a really good sounding resonator too. But I have one of them tuned to open C and one of them open D. I have trouble like switching back between too many tunings, you know, so open C and open D are the same thing, really. Obviously it's just a, you know, C is two steps lower.
Yeah, whole tone above.
But I play a lot of standard tuning slide, you know, on electric and stuff like that. But when you have the open tuning, you can just, you know, all the notes resonate differently, because, you know, it's kind of like a sitar, you know, where you play one note and those other strings resonate with it.
Yeah.
When the guitar is tuned to an open chord, the other strings vibrate sympathetically in a way that they can't really when you're in standard tuning. But I play a lot of standard tuning slide on the electric. You know, you just don't have as many chords you can do, or, you know, you can make a bigger sound in an open tuning, because obviously, you know.
Yeah, they're all. What do you play electric? Like, what are your top three electrics?
They're in the cases, but,
thank you for pulling that out, man. It sounded great.
Yeah.
and a wall of amps that you got there, man.
I'll get to that in a second. As far as the electrics, I've got these two Duesenberg Star Players that I've been playing for about a year and maybe a year and a half now. And I just kind of really thought they were cool looking, honestly, and wanted to try one. And then, you know, I kind of, I picked up the first one off of Craigslist. I got it, you know, this black one. It's a Star Player TV Deluxe, and really dug that. And then I reached out to the company and asked them if you know, they could work a deal on getting another one. And they worked me an artist deal on.
That's
on
awesome. Yeah, they ought to.
But, yeah, but you know, it's, they're really cool. You know, there's a lot going on with them. They've got this kind of their own Bigsby type thing. And you know, they're semi-hollow, which is kind of a new thing for me. I was playing Paul Reed Smiths for years, and I still like them. I still have two custom 22s sitting right over there. But I really dig them, but there's something about the semi-hollow that is a really cool, you know, tone, and, you know, they sustain and feedback in cool ways. And so I've been digging the Duesenbergs lately. And I also put some, you know, I had them refretted and stuff with jumbo frets and all that. So, because they've been like, you know, refretted and all that care done by a guitar repair guy that I know, you know, they play so much better than all my other guitars. They're the first guitars I had professional fret jobs done on.
Yeah.
So now it's hard to play the other guitars that are like off the shelf.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not like they needed to be refretted. I just wanted these really jumbo frets on them. So, yeah, so those have been the go-tos lately.
Did you play those on the two records?
I played the Duesenberg, the black Duesenberg on a couple of things on the Blues of My Blood record, but I think most of those were, I mean, the Burn It Down record was done before I got them.
And, what did you play on that record?
Paul Reed Smith's.
Right.
Yeah. So those are, custom 22, and, I had a Mira at the time, which I ended up getting rid of, but, yeah, Paul Reed Smith's on the Burn It Down record.
And Blues in My Blood, what's on that? Is it the Duesenberg?
Somewhat the Duesenberg, also Paul Reed Smith for a lot of the stuff. Hmm. And, you know, and then that Regal resonator. I didn't have the National yet.
Now, what are you playing out of amp wise? Because you get a great, when you're playing electric blues, man, you have a great, great tone.
So I had this Category 5, that head that's over there, that's like a super, essentially like a hand-wired point-to-point boutique company, Category 5. They're out of Dallas.
Out of Dallas, yeah. I spoke to the owner.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
He's Don. Yeah, he like own a record label too or something like that? Or he does something else?
I didn't even know that.
Yeah, he does something else besides just Category 5. He's a promoter, or he owns a label or something like that.
Okay. Yeah, well,
look at your cat's domino, man. Yeah, man.
Yeah. The Category 5, demo. That's like a super reverb type of, you know, thing, 45 watts, two 606s, you know, that's a really cool amp. It's beautiful overdrive, just, you know, no master volume or anything, just cranking it, and it sounds great. But I also have this other, this Fender head right here is a deluxe reverb. It's a 1966 nice. Deluxe that somebody made into a head. And it's kind of, it's weird. I have a uncle that passed away, and my aunt, my aunt and him were both piano tuners and into music and stuff. And she's going through this garage of stuff, and she sends me this picture of that amp. And she's like, "Do you think you could do anything with this?" And I was like, "Well, yeah, totally."
Hell yeah, 66.
But I was just, I was amazed because I had always wanted that exact sort of thing, which is essentially like a 20 watt, you know, it's like a deluxe, it's a lower watt amp, but it's in a head form. So you can plug it into a variety of different speaker cabinets and stuff. And I don't even know who chopped it and who made it into a head, but it's awesome. And that's what I used on the Blues in My Blood record.
Yeah. That sound was great. Really warm. Hey. Really great, man.
Thank you.
Very cool. Tell me your, I know you said you don't like ranking things, but tell me your knee jerk reaction, top three Desert Island discs just for now. Cause I know that could, you know, yeah, obviously that changes every,
you know. Yeah, I know. I mean, Freddie King Burglar has always been like one that stuck out.
Such a great record. Anything Freddie. Yeah, yeah, man. He's my favorite King, man.
That one. I always keep going back to,
such a great record, you know, man.
I guess if I was to think about like long-term stuff that I have kept coming back to over many, many years, you know, that one, Electric Ladyland by Hendrix, you know, that's something that I liked when I was 12 and I was listening to Metallica. It's something that I liked at every stage of my life. Like Hendrix is always somehow, I've never fallen out of love with Hendrix. And then maybe like Mississippi John Hurt.
That's different.
The 1928 sessions, or it's something really soothing about his stuff. And I've kind of been listening to him more lately.
He's an acoustic fingerstyle guy.
Yeah.
I have to go check that out, because I've never really listened to him. Just maybe in passing. I'm going to have to check that record out.
Yeah.
1928 sessions. Tell me, tough question. What do you like most about yourself?
Huh? Well, you know, these days.
I like that.
I feel like
the start.
I feel like I don't know about a lot of things, but I'm able to admit that I don't know about a lot of things, which I think is perhaps something that more people should be able to do. Like it's like, I'm fine with saying, I don't know a lot about that. Tell me more. You know? Like I don't immediately have a strong opinion about it if I don't know about it.
You mean all these people talking about politics on Facebook may not really know about politics? That's,
yeah, you know, I'm very, it matters to me what counts as true or not, you know. I don't want to just believe something because it feels good to believe it or, you know, so I try to keep myself in check, which is maybe something that I think it's like a good quality to have. You know, that's, you know, obviously it can lead to questioning yourself too much, but I think that we're in an age where more self-reflection can be good. And I certainly try to reflect on whether I'm off base or whether I'm in the wrong in personal situations or whatever. I try to put myself to the test.
Right. It's cool, man. More self-reflection, less mouth, less reaction, right?
That's, yeah.
Fuck, man. Can't have too much of that, I'll tell you right now. I agree with you, man. Flip side of that, is there anything that you'd want to change about yourself?
Well, sure. I guess it would sort of be the yin to that yang or whatever, maybe, like, it, you know, just, I think there's, you know, there's also something to be said for sort of being free of your own editor, you know, mm-hmm. a little bit more. So I'm trying to get, one of the reasons that I really have enjoyed working with different producers lately and plan on continuing that in the near future is that I'm trying to get out of being in the producer seat for myself as much and essentially just trying to get in a mode of expressing more without self-criticism as much, because I do think that, you know, you don't have a really accurate picture of yourself. And so sometimes you have to relinquish that control to other people to say, you know, I think you're on the right track here, or maybe try this or maybe try that, or, you know, and in my case, it's the producers that I've worked with have not even really been that, interested in shaping what I'm doing, but it's more just saying, look, you do the engineering, you do the production, and I'll just be in the zone here musically, because I don't want to stop something before it happens by thinking that, you know, I know exactly how I'm supposed to sound, because I don't, you know. And I think that's, you don't really have an accurate picture of what people like about what you do, you know? And one of the downsides of making music completely on your own, as I did for many years, is that, it's all up to you, you know. You do something and whether it gets released or not is up to you. Whether it's good or not is up to you. And you kind of don't have a good perspective on it sometimes. So I'd say one of the things that maybe is a downside is of myself is I can be a little bit too self-editing to the point where it can stifle creativity, you know, and I have to learn how to like let go of that a little bit.
Are you type A then?
I'd have to remember the definition.
You know, like intense.
I guess so.
So you're like pretty, because you seem like your demeanor is very laid back, but you seem, every a lot of things you've said say like, you know, usually when you're a self-critic, you tend to be intense. And I'm not judging that because I'm like that and I need to be less like that. So I'm right with you. So,
yeah, I mean, I definitely think, you know, it's hard to know where to draw the line between being a control freak and just having like, ideas that you want to see come to fruition, because, you know, I mean, you're not really sure where to step back and let other people play a part in things. You know, I ended up working a lot on my own, just, you know, as a default, you know, I mean, I wanted to make music. There were times where I wanted to create a band, but, you know, in the meantime, I was going to keep making music. And then before you know it, it's like you've spent your whole life making things on your own. You know, so I guess if that makes me type A, I mean, I definitely have been the driving force behind everything that I've done. You know, I've tended to be in control of it. But, you know, that's something. I like the idea of collaboration. It hasn't occurred that many times in my life in a real way. The Tiffany record is one, because it's pretty clear when somebody writes some lyrics and you come up with the music, that's a good way to collaborate.
And that was a home run, dude.
Oh, thanks.
And that's not just my opinion. You got all those awards. So a lot of people felt like that.
Yeah. That was cool. You know? So, I mean, I'm definitely looking to do more of, you know, hopefully collaborating with people in the future and stuff, because I just think it's something I haven't done enough of, you know, just to kind of get out of my own head and bounce things off of other people.
That's cool, man.
Stuff like that.
Get Ken Andrews on there. On it.
Hey, that would be incredible. Yeah.
Something or someone you miss from your childhood.
Oh, wow. something or someone. Well, I guess my grandfather, you know, on my mom's side, he had a decent amount to do with all of us being musicians. He had a music store, you know, he used to sort of entertain me after school, and he, you know, showed me a few things about limited things about music theory, even though I still don't know a whole lot about music theory, but he was just a great person, and he was kind of an inspiring guy. He was a World War II veteran, and he started his own music store, and, you know, that's played cool. Clarinet, you know, and caught snakes and brought them to show people.
He was a man's man.
Yeah, you know, so he's an inspiring guy, so, you know, I wish I could have spent more time with him. I guess he would be one. Yeah.
Most important thing your dad taught you and most important thing your mom taught you?
Well, my dad, he taught me to ride a bike, which I guess is important. No, I don't really ride bikes anymore, but you know, my dad's a really like hard worker. You know, he's a military guy. And, you know, I don't know, just, you know, maybe self-discipline, you know, stuff like that, you know.
You're pretty disciplined, I'm assuming.
I guess in my own way. I mean, you know, I don't necessarily have like a rigid schedule or anything like that. I mean, I haven't been able to have a rigid schedule being on the road a lot of the last many years. But, you know, I whatever the schedule is, but yeah, I mean, you know, I think seeing him work in that type of environment, you know, getting up early every morning and you know, having a military job, it certainly, you know, gives you inspiration to put that type of work ethic into whatever you do. As far as for my mom, you know, my mom was a very creative person, and she has done visual art, and she also does a little bit of music, and you know, she was very supportive of whatever I wanted to try out doing, you know, even when money was tight and stuff, she found a way to get me, you know, a piece of gear if I really needed it or thought I needed it. But, you know, I guess from her, you know, just caring about other people and, you know, and just expressing yourself creatively. You know, she was always coming up with little creative things to do when I was growing up, you know, making little art projects and stuff. So she was more of the art influence, you know.
That's cool, man. You have any, two more questions. You have any hobbies or interests outside of music?
Eric. I have interests outside of music, but it's kind of like along the lines of the philosophy thing, you know. They're not necessarily things that I would call hobbies.
Right.
You know, I'm interested in evolutionary psychology, and I'm interested in, you know, science writing, stuff like that. And world events, you know, but hobby wise, I mean, honestly, I feel like just, other things with music, really. Because, you know, even when I'm trying to focus on doing organic guitar based music, I still really enjoy, you know, sequencing beats and right. That sort of thing, which I honestly have to kind of tell myself not to do. I've sort of cut myself off from doing that a little bit because it can be so enjoyable. It's like rather than video games, I just like creating, like on Ableton Live, you know, like getting in there and sequencing and sound designing and stuff like that. it's that stuff is I guess at this point kind of a hobby because I'm not directly pursuing it. Who knows?
Dude, you'd probably be a good EDM producer at this point.
Well, I certainly know how to use the tools. I think where the breakdown happens is like, I was always interested in like the experimental electronica stuff, not the dance floor stuff. You know what I mean? So I think my lack of interest in being an EDM producer comes from my lack of interest in just creating dance music. But, as far as like, the sounds, I think, are super cool to create sounds and experiment with different textures and things like that. But I've always been more in the, down tempo, whether industrial or trip hop or, whatever other types of electronic stuff and not like house music or, totally. Club music.
And, last question, man, what's been the biggest change in your personality over say the last 5 to 7 years and how much of that has been intentional and how much is just a natural part of aging?
Biggest change in my personality. I guess I've learned how to deal with different personality types a little bit better. In this industry, there's a lot of different personality types and, I try to be more understanding of people's backgrounds and, how that affects the way that they see things and the way that they maybe react to things. And
yeah, man, that is true.
I've tried to get better at not always reacting.
Trying to myself. Figure out why someone's being a dick and just assuming they're a dick.
Right. Yeah. I guess that's a
why are you presenting like this?
Right. Yeah. Because, everybody has, we're all a product of circumstances.
Yeah.
Whether they're genetic or environmental. And, a lot of times it just doesn't do you a lot of good to go, well, why did that person react this way? They should have reacted this other way that I would have preferred. And, it's just like dealing with other animals. You kind of just, you learn how they act and you try to work with it. And it doesn't mean that you forgive people if you think that they're not healthy for you to be around, but, I just try to be more understanding, rather than viewing people like, they sort of design themselves to be evil or something,
My buddy had this thing. He always used to tell me, he goes, Craig, don't have expectations. And you know what? He's right. And it makes it not for any other reason other than makes your life less stressful.
Right.
Yeah. And you don't take things personal. And that's for me, that's what I've found anyway. And having kids helped me out a lot. Not that, I had expectations of my kids and they failed, but you see that everybody's different. It's just, you don't know why certain things happen. And sometimes you're right. Sometimes it's environment it just makes your life less stressful when you don't have expectations.
Yeah. Yeah. And, I think like traveling around and seeing a lot of different people, one thing that I wish that people would understand or kind of get through their heads at this point is that everyone around the planet is good people.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Yeah.
There's very few psychopaths and sociopaths in the world. So I try to look at even if I disagree with people and I think that maybe even if they're supporting something that I think is bad, just try and think that they're misguided and that maybe, if you were able to see eye to eye on things, maybe you'd find common ground because, I think it's really weird right now how we're sort of, you know, almost like viewing people as evil just because they disagree with us on things. And it's easy to do because you can go, well, if you believe this and that leads to this and that leads to this, and then therefore you're as bad as the end result of your thinking. But, you know, people learn, people grow, and you know, I think that people are by and large good everywhere, you know?
No, I agree with you, man. I don't understand all this harshery. I think it's, you know, social media just seems to have given a platform, and it's almost like, well, you're expected to have a team, and then you're expected to react viscerally to the opposite right. team. And, you know, never once in my life of 56 years did I ever ask somebody a question before I'm deciding to have a conversation with them, work with them, listen to music with them, anything, have an interview with them. I've never asked anybody, like, what are your political views? What do you feel about this? It's none of my damn business, frankly. And then there are people out there say, well, you're being ignorant because it is your business. No, it really isn't.
Yeah.
It's not my business.
Things matter. You know, issues matter. World politics, you know, all these things matter. And to me, everything, you don't really have a choice to not be affected by things that go on in the world because, of course, you're involved in it. But, you know, I, for instance, I did a 3-week tour in Russia a few years ago. This is back in like 2015. So Russia wasn't really as much on the topic of conversation for most people. You know, of course, you know, I met all kinds of great people. And so then I started to feel like, well, what would it feel like now that they're more of the topic of controversy?
Right.
Well, again, nothing's changed with the average person.
Yeah, the average person going to your concert or going to a club.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing is, you know, and I think that is no matter what country it is, I mean, you know, where everyone is, you know, just trying to live their own life.
Get through the day, man. Everybody's just trying to get through another day.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with you there.
So that's one of the cool things about playing music is that, you know, you get to see different people in different places and you know, I like that a lot. I like traveling and I like, you know, meeting different people and
what's the favorite place you traveled?
Well, you know, favorite from a just a beauty standpoint, I mean, New Zealand still ranks up there pretty high.
I figured you were going to say that, actually.
You know, I mean, St. Petersburg, Russia was probably one of the most impressive cities I've ever been in. And just in terms of like, just, you know, the architecture and everything was amazing. I haven't really done much Europe stuff.
How does St. Petersburg, Russia compare to St. Petersburg, Florida? No, I'm just kidding. I'm totally kidding.
Hey, Florida's got, you know.
Not please. Totally kidding.
Is that where you're at? Where
I'm in Tampa. It's right across the bay. Tampa. Yeah, okay, it's yeah, right. St. Pete.
Yeah, you guys have that festival in St. Petersburg.
Yeah, we the Blues Festival. Have you played that?
Yeah. I've been there. I don't think I've been booked for it directly. I was on a tour with Tab that one of the dates was that he played that and I was opening up the rest of the shows. But
oh, cool. Yeah. I think that's Derek and Susan's show because they close it every year. I don't know for sure. I mean, I've never asked anybody that, but they headline every year's show. So I just said, well, it must be their show because there's two of them. There's one here and then there's one over in the East Coast of Florida in Boca Raton.
Okay.
So it's like the Vinoy Park here, which is in St. Pete. And then there's one on the East Coast. I've been to that festival once. It was really good just to see.
Yeah.
I had great seats, man. And Derek was just like on fire that night. And it was pretty cool to see that. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was pretty cool to see that. And I was with my son at the time. This was probably 10 years ago. So he was like 19. And I've seen hundreds of shows. What he did just in the encore, I told my son, I said, man, you're never going to see this again in your life. So just appreciate what you just saw.
Yeah, I first met Derek when I was about 16 or 17. And we played, I played the same festival.
You and, guys are around the same age. I would have really not too
he's
far.
He's a little bit older.
Yeah.
I forget how many years older. He's a little bit older, but then I used to go see him as Derek Chuck's band whenever I could, you know, when they come to New Orleans and stuff. But yeah, I don't really know him anymore. Like, I never really knew him. I met him, but, I know friends of mine that are friends with him and stuff, but he's a phenomenon.
Yeah. When he's on, it's not even human at what he's doing, man. It's just amazing.
Yeah.
You know? And I don't say that about too many people. Eric, let me tell people where they could find you and what you got going on. And thank you very much for your time, man. I really appreciate you sharing your journey, and I'm excited to see what your next record is going to be like.
Yeah, man. Thank you.
So it's Eric Johansson, Johansson. He's got a really good website at ericjohansson.com. First thing, I'd like to encourage you to go to his website and enter your email there, because when his new record comes out later this year, you'll be on the list. Are you on social media?
Yeah.
For listeners, where do they go?
Facebook is facebook.com/ericjohanssonblues. Instagram is eric.johansson.
Awesome.
Website ericjohansson.com.
Awesome. And check out Eric's other projects. One is called Sire, but it's spelled C-I-R-E. And that record, I'm sorry, I have it on a separate sheet of paper here. That record is...
It's Wholesale Buyout and Adrenological.
What's that?
I mean, the records are...
Oh, the two... Talking about the records? Yeah. What are the records called?
Wholesale Buyout and Adrenological are the two ones I'd point people to.
And so check that out. That's progressive rock music. You could tell... Those are perfect titles for prog rock stuff, man. I don't... There's a bunch of syllables in there, man. It's like an SAT word, both of them. And also check out Empty Self, one word, EMPTYSELF. Eric's got a couple albums there. That's his electric project. What are the two records titled there?
The first one was self-titled, and the second one was called Nothing Follows, Nothing Stays.
Awesome. Nothing Follows, Nothing Stays, and then Empty Self. And check out Burn It Down, which is his solo record, which is great. And check out Blues in My Blood, which is his record with his first cousin, Tiffany Pollock. Both of those records are really cool, and I'm looking forward to hearing what your next album is like coming this year. And it'd be cool to see what direction you take it in, man. And all that, I could see the wheels turning in your head when you were talking about all the stuff you've got written. So it'll be nice to see what comes out, man. I know it'll be great. Anything else I forgot? Anything else you want to mention?
Not that I can think of, man.
Right on, man. Well, thank you so much for your time. Hang on, let me wrap this up. Everybody, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this, please share it on your social media channels. We appreciate your support. Please support Eric Johansson Music. Again, check it out. Burn It Down, which is his self-titled record, and Blues in My Blood. Also, Empty Self and Sire, C-I-R-E, and hit him up on social media channels. And most important, remember that happiness is a choice, so choose wisely. Be nice. Go play your guitar and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out. Eric, thanks for everything, man.
Yeah, thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.